Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Carl Carlson. Welcome.
Hello, Fred.
Hey. And we were just chatting offline for a few minutes, and one of the things that we recognized is that of all of the topics, when the group of us got together to record our 100th episode, which, by the way, should be coming up in about, if my numbering system is working, this should be like 4 or 5 episodes from now. But it was a pretty exciting topic, and lots of ideas came out of it. I need to listen through it again and just list them. But one of them was this idea of the impact of all of these sensors and all of these measurements and all of the techniques we have available today to monitor our equipment. And I think you mentioned that it's the concept of big data. And that's changed. And Carl, in your experience and in mine, kind of growing up in the reliability field, data was treasure and it was expensive to get when we started.
Yeah, I think back to my days in the Fisher Body Test Lab where we were testing car bodies, and we had little information compared to today about the exact loads that customers see, the exact temperatures and humidities. We went to great effort to record the operating profiles and conditions of use and all the different duty profiles throughout the life of a vehicle. And you're right, that information was treasured and really valuable.
And well, you compare that to today, in order for a driverless car to navigate, just think of all of the telemetry and information they're gathering. That's an amazing amount of information. It's not exactly the reliability information of temperature and loads and stresses and so on, yet that capability is certainly there to gather terabytes of data per hour of driving.
Yes, it is. So the challenge, thinking in the new paradigm, so we're existing in an era of easily available or much more easily available data, the challenge becomes what data, how to evaluate it, how to design in the capability to utilize it, and what data is needed to achieve high reliability. So it's just a lot of different aspects to this conversation.
Well, I'm trying to remember, Carl, at RAMS, were you with me when we were talking to, he was a... I don't know if he was a professor, but worked at a university in Germany that was with the auto industry kind of approach, and really looking at all of the data that's already being collected by the engine sensors and by the various drivetrain sensors and electronics, and just struggling with how do we make sense of all this data and which are precursors to things we care about. How can we do that prognostic health analysis, basically, to say we need to, adjust the alignment, or we need to change this or change that?
Yeah, no, I wasn't with you, Fred, but that's a great conversation. So here's a couple thoughts. Going back to first principles, one of the usages of data is, I'll call it degradation analysis, where you have an impending failure, but it hasn't manifested.
Well, and that works with certain kinds of failure mechanisms. You know, fluorescent light bulb, for example, will slowly fade, or an LED will slowly fade, and so the light output will slowly deteriorate, and then it's arbitrary where we say, all right, it's too dim, it's not working.
Exactly.
Right? And so it might be the power output of your motor in the drivetrain, right? The engine provides a certain amount of torque or power, and if it slowly is losing its capability to provide that much power, then that would be degradation. But it's different than, say, an incandescent light bulb that is a nice, bright 60-watt bulb, although it's politically incorrect here in California to buy them anymore. But when it fails, it just fails. It just doesn't light up at all.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's no precursor to know when it's going to go.
What a great subject, because this comes back to requirements. So if there's a luminosity requirement in that example, so then when you go below that luminosity value, that by definition of failure. And of course, another aspect of failure is no light at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So now if we're collecting, I think what you're getting at though, with this first principles is understanding the failure mechanism and
yes.
understanding the pattern that leads to failure, however it is that we define it.
Yes.
And I think that's still, I'm being the devil's advocate here, because that's still, there's another whole class of failures that won't catch. And that's when another car hits your car, you know, or,
yes.
you know, a lightning bolt hits it, or a massive overstress situation that in many cases would be considered outside the normal operating condition. A tree falls on it, for example, and breaks your headlight. Well, now you get no light out of your headlight.
Right. So staying with first principles, we can capture a portion of the impending failures through degradation analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you have an impending accident, we can capture the approach of that accident through sensors.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say someone's encroached on your envelope or your perimeter.
Right.
And then take evasive action. So it seems like we can at least get a lot of those if they can be anticipated. So here becomes the challenge. If you can anticipate the mechanism of failure, which would include accidents by mechanism, I mean a very broad definition of mechanism, the manner in which something fails, if you can anticipate it, then you can identify what leads up to it and then begin sensing or capturing data that alerts you to that possibility.
You know, this takes me back. I remember a story from one of the inventors of the what we commonly call a Xerox machine, a copier. And they knew that through risk assessment, and this was a brand new product, a brand new functionality, which this ability to photocopy something and create a digital or a hard copy representation of, say, a book page or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that wasn't done before. And so these guys were thinking through, well, how could this not work? And they looked at light intensity and motor speeds and belts and gears and all of the different various mechanisms that went into this thing. And one of the thoughts was, well, this is a big sheet of glass that's on the top. What if somebody drops the book on it? And so they went to the library and they found the biggest Tonkinist book they could, right? And they mm-hmm. and they kind of thought through somebody flipping the page and it would drop from like a foot down onto this glass and hit it at just the wrong place. And so they plussed up the size of the glass and they reinforced the structure so that it would withstand that amount of force. And lo and behold, within a few months after they started shipping these things, they had broken glass. And and nobody, you know, the customers just say, hey, the glass broke, you know, and
yeah.
not great information from that source, which I don't think has changed all that much. Customers will tell us that, hey, it's not working, you know.
No, that hasn't changed.
Right. Very
and
few
so
people.
Will dealers.
That's right. And dealers. Yeah, that's true. You know, people don't say they dropped their phone in the toilet. They say mm-hmm. it got wet.
Right.
So anyway, they went down to the lab and they replicated the amount of force it would take to cause that fracture they were seeing. And it was orders of magnitude more than they'd ever anticipated. You know, and lo and behold, it was people jumping up at it and taking pictures of their butt, basically. and it was an unanticipated
yes.
activity. But yeah. it took them months and months to sort that out, whereas what we've got now is if we want to know what kind of loads our shock system is experiencing, is we can put sensors all over that and give it to a bunch of people and let it run. And it won't impede their ability to use the car. And there's, I mean, the people will worry about privacy issues and all these other things, but we can, that kind of data is already being collected in many different functions of a vehicle. And so when you take it into the shop and they plug it into their computer system, it interrogates it. Hey, you know, what's your experience been?
So the challenge for reliability engineers, bringing it back to this, the topic of how it impacts our field, the challenge is now that we have all this data or that we can easily get it, what do we do with it? Mm-hmm. What portions of this massive, call it overload of data, is meaningful to the reliability engineer, and how do you utilize that information to either design in reliability or to monitor reliability and usage? Becomes the challenge.
Yeah. Well, one of the most useful things that even when data was difficult to get, most useful thing back to the design team was that this filling in the blanks for the ability to calculate the stress strength interactions and curves. Oftentimes mm-hmm. our designers had a data sheet for a component, or they had a drawing and a simulation, a finite element model for a physical, a mechanical material, but they didn't know what the loads would be. And so creating that set of distributions, just even in the old days, it was just, well, here's the max, the temperature range we expect the product to go under. But a significant improvement to that is saying, well, here's where our customers actually use our product. Here's the distribution of temperatures for our different customers. And that just became, it's a histogram, would became a huge improvement. Now, if we could, with the amount of data we have available, we can slice that by, you know, customers in Florida, customers in Colorado, you know, different regions of the world, different use conditions, different applications. And it gives us much more dimensionality to just what's our temperature spec.
Yeah, very good. And now during product development, Fred, the question becomes, how do you utilize this information or obtain the information during product development? And I think we can use the same logic of the stress strength interference and gathering the usage information during testing. Mm-hmm. So if we have the right sensors available during testing, then you can simulate the customer usage before you've launched the product and before you have the product in the field.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did this same basic approach with a handheld device one time. Is one of the identified risks was that if somebody sits on this, and if the polymer fractures, and it, we knew from the polymer materials that it would break and it would create a sharp edge. So we didn't want somebody sitting on something breaking and it behaving like a knife, like a sharp edge, piece of glass, essentially. We thought that was a safety concern. So we wanted to make sure that we had enough margin between the strength of the system versus the loads of somebody sitting on it. Well, we didn't know either part of this equation. So it was off to the lab to find out, and we got a handful of units and an Instron machine and found out what it took to break these things. So we got a glimpse of the strength distribution of this thing. And then it correlated well with our finite element model. And it was using, you know, different structures and different ways of force being applied to it, either a point source or a more broad source or all kinds of different ways. And if you're, we even thought through, is it on the floor? Is it on the carpet? Is it on the couch? Is it, you know, where is it? And then we went in and started looking at, well, what is the force that a human can apply? Right. Mm-hmm. And so gathered up a bunch of people and put sensors on them and had them sit down.
Yeah, exactly. So all that can be simulated during product development all that information and then utilize. I just had another thought, Fred, on I'm not sure how many of our listeners are familiar with degradation analysis, so let me just state it a different way, which mm-hmm. is one of the nightmares of a reliability test engineer is that you've suspended testing just before a failure. I mean, that's the one that should keep you up at night.
Yeah. We often assume that it's going to fail in the next moment when yeah. we do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you do from a calculation standpoint. And but you don't want to pass something that is obviously we're better off if we test a failure and we understand our limits and we've done all of that. But in many cases, your engineers are involved in protocols that include a certain pass-fail test. And the nightmare there is that you've passed it and it's right near a failure point.
That's right, just before the ledge, the cliff.
Yeah, exactly. And with sensors and with data, you can then predict, like if you know that something fails, if it gets a crack becomes 6 centimeters long, if you're measuring that crack and it's, say, you know, a millimeter, 6 centimeters would be way too long, but too big.
Right.
Say six. But just the concept of it, if you're measuring the crack propagation, then you can then predict better how close you are to the failure. Same with temperature. If you know that a certain temperature exceeded is going to fail, if you're measuring the temperature and then can predict what it's going to be, that gives you a better idea when the failure will occur. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that technique is used as much as it can be or should be.
Well, it's not a simple problem to solve. Oftentimes you take some, a little bit more math, a little bit more thought process. It also takes understanding the accumulated nature of the failure mechanism.
Yes, it does.
Whether it's and then the statistics of doing repeated measures, the mm-hmm. recurrent data is also not straightforward. So it builds on the basic idea that if I have a piece of metal and I bend it back and forth enough times, it'll crack and break, and I can relate cycles to failure. Whereas degradation is looking at what's the material structure changes over time such that it gets brittle and then breaks.
Yes.
So it's another level of detail. I don't think this is any different whether we have big data or not. I believe it enables us to ask that our systems are gathering data that points to change in performance or change in structure such that we can apply these degradation rules.
Yeah, I agree. The science and the physics and the mathematics that goes into damage models is can be challenging. Once it's done, once we have the models in place, then it becomes very useful. But it isn't as simple as a linear equation.
No. And one of the best applications I've seen was this particular device had 30 or so known failure mechanisms. You know, when it got down to exactly how did this device fail, it had about 30 different ways that it failed, short of, you know, somebody stepping on it or completely outside the normal use scope, which they had a budget for, the, you know, people dropping it or other malicious attack or all kinds of other stuff that would happen with the product. But if it was behaving properly, it would still wear out. It would still fail. It would still accumulate damage. And they had approximately 30 models for that. And each model had different drivers, different accelerants. Some were temperature, some were use, some were humidities in different things. So they built a database of all of those stressors and instrumented very deliberately to get good data on those areas. And then they combined with their characterization of the failure mechanisms, they created the equations, essentially. And sometimes they were physics of failure equations, first principles all the way. Mm-hmm. And other times it was purely test data. You know, it was empirically driven off of some test data, and they worked to improve it. And then they would correlate it to the field results. They had pretty good field returns data and failure analysis. And so over time, And the last I heard was this model has been in use for like 14 years. But once you get to that stage, this use of a lot of information and data, along with the ability to translate it into time to failure, which is what where we come in, became the driving force for their R&D lab. So essentially, if you wanted to propose a project to improve the product, you had to show using this model they built, and it was built on a Monte Carlo type simulation system, that it would have a material effect. So that if I changed this material set so that I would have fewer of X, Y, and Z type failures, you would propose that this is how it would happen. And then you'd run the model to say, well, even if it worked perfectly, would it make a difference? Would it even apply? Yeah. Would anybody care? And so it became the gate for the projects they adopted. And then it became the outcome of a proposal for improvement or a change in materials or product that it had to then be built back into the overall model. And so it became a driving force for their R&D lab. And that was a reliability model.
I'm curious. This is great. The great case study that you're outlining there. I'm curious if I know education and courses have modeling, a lot of modeling. I wonder how much the current curricula includes the impact of big data on reliability engineering and management. Just a curiosity. Yeah.
Well, let's ask our listeners. They're all over the world. It might be a good spot to wrap it up is, well, what are you seeing? I heard about one program in Germany where they were taking available automotive data, basically that you could pull out of a vehicle when it goes into servicing, and trying to find what are the precursors to failures. And they were building a program, a curricula around that. And I think it was more on the research side is what this team was working on. But outside of that, I think there's a handful of organizations and courses and so on that extend modeling to the readily available data.
Health prognostics.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm trying to think of it like LSEAD at Rutgers and PECT at Maryland and others I know are talking about prognostic health management, which touches on this idea, but I don't think it's prevalent yet.
No, it's emerging.
Yeah. So if you want to get ahead of the game dive into this topic, yet it goes back to the start of reliability engineering is understanding how things fail. What are the fundamentals, the first principles, as we often say, and what are those basics? And that's really the foundation to making sense of all the data that you have.
Very good, Fred.
All right. Well, let's wrap this one up and leave that question out there and let us know. You can go to reliability.fm and find our episode and let us know what you think. And so we'll look forward to hearing from you, and we'll probably do a follow-up on this topic. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.